And this is part B of our interview with Emma Carney. If you haven't yet listened to part A, jump over to that right now.
It really is interesting because reading that part, like, in many ways you're a trailblazer. You were unique in your approach, and if you had been a bloke, people would have said, shit, what's he doing? We better emulate that because clearly that works. But because perhaps you're a female and you wouldn't conform to what the male coaches and administration were saying, that you were seen as not part of the team. Doesn't seem right.
I think that played into it to some extent. And, you know, when I first started triathlon, I was told that it was a Queensland, New South Wales sport. And, you know, why did I spend so much time in Victoria? And I said, well, I live here. Different, an odd scenario. But what I don't like, or what I will always champion now, is that this should not happen. This should not happen anymore. And, you know, I'm now coaching high performance. I'm coaching another Emma. and the story behind that is Emma Hogan, so who I coach, she...
And that's... It's very fortuitous that her name is Emma, right?
Well, to an extent, I was... I have a lot of conversations with, you know, the so-called experts, and they're always talking about data. Now, when I retired from triathlon, obviously I'm Emma. Emma Snowsall came along. Emma Moffat came along. So that was three Emmas, world champions from Australia. And so if you look at the data, guys, just pick someone with the name Emma. And they're like, oh, don't be so silly. Anyway, I actually think Emma's going to be a world champion and be the best athlete that they've got.
Yeah.
But she's still very unsupported. You know, she's from Proserpine, far north Queensland. She's doing her training in Victoria. Just use your talent. Support it. It still goes on today, and it's really quite amazing.
You're an ambassador for Change Our Game. Clearly, part of what you're trying to do is just that. You know, change the game and change that perspective. Is there light on the hill? Like, do you see that it is starting to shift the way that it should shift?
I think so. I think there's still a long way to go. I think, you know, girls and growing up with sport, you know, they might have thought, oh, God, I'm really crap at sport. But actually they were wearing a small men's uniform, so they felt awful. Those sort of things. I remember when I ran for Australia for the first time, I was really surprised. The uniform was huge. And I said, oh, do you have a smaller one? And they said, no, that's extra small men's. We don't go any smaller. I said, really? And, you know, when Dad started at Nike, Dad said, where's the women's range? And then the guys, the Nike head office said, oh, women don't like to sweat. Yeah, you know, that was just the 80s.
Yeah, well.
You know, 84 we watched the first women's marathon, the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had no idea when I was a kid, because I was just fortunate as a girl. I think my school very much helped with that support. But I was very, very fortunate that I never considered being a girl was a problem. But there were so many things, even, you know, down at Box Hill running track, I ran for Box Hill. And when the men had finished training, they'd turn the lights out. So there's me running around in the dark because I was part of the women's team.
Yeah.
So I'd just see Dad yelling at officials and going, oh, something must be going on.
Just keep running in the dark. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, encouraging young women and girls and, you know, having change rooms where you've actually got your own change rooms and you feel safe in the toilets. You go for a run in a park. All that sort of stuff.
I'm going to switch gears a little. Back to the height of your career. So you were sponsored by Holden, Trek, NAB, Adidas, flying all over the globe to record TV commercials. You're meeting people like Steffi Graf and you're getting letters from the PM and crowds are, you know, flocking around you. How was that bit? Like, I know that when you're racing, like, you're brutal. How did you, I guess, navigate or enjoy that part of your career?
That was kind of hard work. Because, to be honest.
More hard work.
Yeah, because I didn't do it for that. I did it because I hated losing and I wanted to be a part of I wanted to be remembered that I'd turned up and, you know, done triathlon. It was quite full on. I remember I used to, down in Eltham, God, I remember I went to the supermarket one day and I said to Mum, I can't go supermarket shopping anymore. You're on groceries. I don't even know why I went. Wearing Adidas stuff, I was very highly recognisable. So I started just wearing plain things if I wasn't doing an appearance.
Big baseball cap, aviator sunglasses.
No, I didn't do that so much. But, I mean, I didn't really get out much because, I mean, as a triathlete, you're training, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day. If you've got the energy to go out, well, it's probably, what, a coffee?
Yeah.
Get someone to carry you there.
And back then it was a Nescafe in a cup. Like, there were no lattes. Yeah.
But, no, Adidas was a really, really good sponsor. They treated me really well. Those TV ads were big productions, very big, and I can't act. That was one thing I never did at school was a school play. I was rubbish at music and drama. Rubbish.
So there they are giving you these lines and you can't act. Yeah, it must have been hard work.
Yeah.
So you continue to compete and over time your performance starts to come back to the pack a bit because you're continually plagued with tiredness and fatigue. Can you take us to the moment I think it was in 2004, it was lead up to Athens, you're in a team bus, your heart's racing, it drives away, a taxi's called, but you actually need an ambulance, and your one good bra is cut off you. Take us there.
I know, what a disastrous day. About 1996, 97, I started to feel a little bit weak. So my race was all about minimising the damage in the swim, getting on the bike, finding my legs, and then ripping apart the field or deciding to sit and then rip apart the field on the run. But whatever, there was some sort of ripping apart of the field and very sort of powerful attacks and things like that. And I started to feel less powerful. And I sort of was dizzy and it was sort of wash over me like a horrible, oh, I feel really weak all of a sudden. And the one place it really used to get me was at the start because in a triathlon you dive in and you sprint to the first swim can. So I was getting about, and it's normally about 300 metres away. So I was getting about halfway and I'd get this feeling wash over me and I'd have to sort of back off and get through. At the time everyone's like, oh, Carney, she's such a crap swimmer. Look at her. She goes out the back door. But it was a sudden change. Anyway, I sort of didn't tell anyone because, you know, that's hashtag soft. So I just sort of trained harder and tried to get through things. I got Sydney Games, that schmozzle. I was still earmarked for Athens Games. And I was having these good patches, bad patches, very unpredictable. I was no longer dominant, but I was still, you know, like a world-class triathlete. 2004, I'd been up at the AIS and I'd been training really well. And training was different because you did a warm-up. You didn't go into a sudden, intense effort. And we were doing it was a Thursday before a Sunday race, a triathlon over there. And I pushed off the wall and I felt this weakness wash over me. And I thought, oh, my God, in training now. So weird. Anyway, following that, my heart, I could feel straight away elevated and in my chest and was like a panic. I thought, oh, my God, I'm panicking. So I forced myself to finish the set and I was really struggling to breathe and got out of the pool and got myself, you know, changed. And my biggest fear was to end up because I felt like I was going to pass out. I thought, oh, I can't pass out nude. Got myself out of the pool. I thought maybe it was the thick air of the indoor pool. Got out there and there's the team management and got on the team bus, heading back to the hotel. And my heart was still racing in my chest. And the heart is a muscle. And so you can imagine like a calf strain or a hamstring strain. It feels like a really tight muscle and it pulls. So when you're approaching cardiac arrest and you've been in in that arrhythmia for that long, it starts to feel like a ball and pulls your shoulders forward. And so you sit in the bus and your shoulders are being pulled forward. So I waited until we got to the lights and I stood, you know, got out and I sort of put my hands above my head to try and open my chest, but I could still feel my heart racing. And they were like, oh, get in the car, Carney. Anyway, the lights changed and they drove off. And I thought, oh, God, I really hate my team.
Oh, my God, they just drove off.
They drove off. And actually the guy running the show has just been appointed by the AIS as a coach mentor. So we've still got the same guys in the system. But anyway, that's another story. Anyway, fortunately the physio said, oh, you can't just leave her. So he jumped out and he was, you know, and I thought, I can't even breathe now. And I thought, right, I can't panic, because if I panicked, something was going on with my heart. I'd worked that out. I reckon I wouldn't have enough air to live. So he was whinging, oh, what are we doing, Carney? You're such an idiot. Now it's raining. And I thought, I've got to make him panic. So I said, look, Wazza. I had a guy called Wazza that was going to save my life. Things are not looking good. Anyway, I told him, I said, Wazza, you got to get help or just let me die. Just don't whinge to me. Anyway, he ran off and I thought, oh, God, I wonder if he's coming back. But fortunately, he dropped his bag, so I had complete faith in that bag that he was coming back. He came back with an cab.
Taxi, yeah.
And I said, nah. The cabbie took one look and said, she needs an ambulance. So an ambulance came, and the ambulance, we're about 250 metres away from a cardiac hospital. So, you know, they stuck me on a stretcher and I just thought, I must remember to stay awake, because if I lay on the floor, because I was now lying on the floor, I thought when I shut my eyes, it was really peaceful, and that frightened me because I'd never had that much peace. And I'm not sure whether that was me drifting off, but anyway, I didn't go there. And I thought, I must remember to tell them I've got a low resting heart rate. And so they, you know, stuck me on the stretcher and they stuck all the sticky things on, and of course they cut my T-shirt, and then they went to cut my bra. And as an athlete, when you go overseas for sort of 6 months, you've got all your training gear and you've got one good bra. Had my good bra on. And I'm like, no, guys, I got my good bra on. I can undo it. And they said, no, we don't have time. And they were flicking my feet and I couldn't feel it. So I started to shut down. Heart rate was 248. Oof. So I'd been in that arrhythmia for close to an hour. So normally the heart would only last 15 minutes and then flick into a fibrillation and you've got sudden death, which my cardiologist tells me is not ideal, Emma. Anyway, they said, we're going to give you a shock. I thought, oh, I wonder what that is. And then everyone stepped back and I heard a switch flick and I thought, oh, my God. And I realised I had, like, pads stuck to my chest and, wow, that. My cardiologist always says to me, what did that feel like, Emma? And I'm like, Prof, you want to lie on the bed and I'll just give you a bolt of electricity through your chest? 250 joules just whacked through my chest. He said he's never known anyone to have that fully conscious. And I said, well, Prof, you've got one patient.
Yeah.
Anyway,
What did it feel like?
It was like being hit by a truck and then you're really surprised you're still there. Mm. So you definitely come off the bed and you land, but then there's no panic in your chest, everything's fine. But your language is really bad because you start ripping pads off. And every time someone came near me, I had my arms crossed for about 2 days after that.
Yeah. Don't come
just
near
like
me.
That thing. No.
Subsequently, what were you diagnosed with? And today you've got something that travels with you every day to keep you on the straight and narrow.
So they were a little bit suspicious at the time. So this is 2004. They were suspicious that endurance athletes were showing right ventricular problems. So basically with a heart, you have plumbing or electrical problems. Plumbing is like, you know, you need a stent to keep a valve open or something like that. Electrical problems, we've all got a natural pacemaker at the top of our hearts, sends a signal to the bottom and the heart beats. When you train, you know, you break muscle down, you rest, it repairs, strengthens, and that's how you become fitter. Sometimes you can break down heart muscle because it's a muscle. So I've created a little patch of scar tissue on my right ventricle wall. So when the signal's sent down, sometimes it diverts off to this scar tissue and the heart doesn't receive the signal, so it goes into a bit of a spasm, like an eye twitch. So if you do that for long enough, the heart is like an eye twitch and we just go into a spasm and go into fibrillation where there's no blood in, no blood out. It can be twitching at like 600 and you're dead within 5 minutes. So my heart, so initially at this time they were suspicious this could happen in endurance athletes, but it was only showing in male endurance athletes in Europe. And then I rock up, an Aussie female athlete. And, right ventricular, I've got a patch of scar tissue in my right ventricle wall. A lot of the tests, my heart failed anyway because it's very enlarged, very low resting heart rate. So the normal profiles of a heart, it was quite difficult to diagnose. But it shows that instability, so I've got a defibrillator implanted, which doesn't give you the same massive shock, fortunately. Mm.
So when it was clear that your career was coming to an end and you could no longer reach the heady heights that you'd reached, how did you deal with that?
Terribly. Well, initially I was like, I suppose my cardiologist might still say I'm in denial because I was like, never exercise again. But it's really, really quite difficult. No response from Triathlon Australia. I was sent a letter from the AIS to thank for my contribution to Australian sport. And that was it. And then I went into a very, very, very tragic part of my life where my sister was diagnosed with cancer. So, and we lost Jane from diagnosis to death. She died within 5 months. She just had a child and she left behind a five-month-old and husband and, things just couldn't get any worse. And then I got married and they did.
So let's talk about that, if you will. Like as you're saying, like life post your career hasn't been easy. You mentioned you tragically lost your sister Jane and you ended an abusive marriage, and you do admit in your book that you really did struggle at times. What was clear from reading your book and meeting you is that you've got this crazy level of determination and I think belief in yourself. You actually were heading into the family court.
Is that in my book? Did I actually write that?
No, you didn't. And tell us about this if you're happy to. You don't have to. But I, when I saw that, I thought that's just someone who has this amazing self-belief in the need to be 100%
committed.
Committed.
Yeah, you've got to be committed.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I ended up in family court, and that is a miserable. You remember how we said you don't ever want to dip into misery too far?
Yeah.
Don't go to family court because that is misery done well.
Yeah.
So we went to family court, and one day we're walking there, and my lawyer on the way there, he said, maybe, and he mentioned my ex-husband's name, maybe he's got a point. And I stopped and I said, what? And he said, maybe he's got a point. And I said, okay, so if you're showing any sign of weakness, you are now fired. And he said, what? I said, you're fired. I'll do it myself. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, I'll defend myself. He said, you can't do that. You're not a lawyer. I said, yes, I can. I said, you're no longer my lawyer. Anyway, we walked into the family court and he was all grumpy with me. And he said, are you sure? I said, I've never been more sure in my life. Don't ever flinch if you're on my side. So we went in there and the judge, looked at my ex and me and was like, oh, God, here we go. And my lawyer stood up and said, oh, Your Honour, I'm stepping down as Miss Carney's lawyer and here's my affidavit. And the judge, you could just see he just lost the will to live, just momentarily.
Right.
Because he was like, oh, my God. And he looked, he watched my lawyer, you know, hand the bit of paper in and hand to the clerk, and my lawyer left the room, and the judge looks at me. He said, Miss Honor, you need to come to the Miss Carney, you need to come to the bench. So I went to the bench, you know, like a naughty schoolgirl.
Right. Like in all those movies.
like I was back at Wesley.
Yeah.
And he said, do you know the workings of this court? And I thought, I thought, no, I don't. I said, no, Your Honour. And so anyway, he ended up throwing us both out. We had to have counselling. We're done in 30 minutes. So it was funny. It was, I mean, not funny as in ha-ha, but it was odd that I just had never had anyone on my side when something was so serious suggest that someone else possibly had a point. Because they don't ever have a point if you're in competition.
I thought that example, like when I saw that example, I saw it on another podcast that you did, and I just thought that sums up a lot about what makes you up. In 2012, Triathlon Australia inducted you into the Hall of Fame. 2014, the International Triathlon Union inducted you into the Hall of Fame. And you mentioned earlier in 2016 you were became a Sports Australia Hall of Fame, which is the greatest honour for any Australian athlete. And you might have touched on this earlier, but surely the benefit of hindsight and accolades like that has to tell you can look back at your career and the experience of writing a book and going, shit, I've achieved a lot, and that was amazing.
I think what you can say about my career is that I did as much as I could when I could. There was a lot more I should have done, and, you know, circumstances in life, you know, we'll probably get to the end of – well, I mean, when they finally chuck me in a hole at the end of my life, they'll say, well, she had a red hot go. And she's really broken. But, yeah, I mean, I'm very, very proud of what I did and my reputation. You know, if I'm ever at the Sport Australia Hall of Fame, you know, great athletes will say, oh, Emma, you really knew how to win.
Mm.
And that, to me, is the biggest accolade you can get.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be out there making up numbers. You want to know that – and this is part of my coaching as well. You know, I coach athletes to represent this country and do this country proud. It's not about filling in numbers. It's not about, oh, yeah, I'd like to be a triathlete, because if you want that kind of job, it's not the sport for you.
Mm. You're not actually Emma Carney. You're Jack's mum.
Jack's mum.
Yeah. Does he understand that you are a world champion? Do you tell him?
No, I never actually told him. So all Jack's seen of me is at the Noosa Triathlon every year they have a Legends race.
Yeah.
And I can't go hard, otherwise my defibrillator will go off. So yes. My defibrillator, if my heart rate gets above 150, it starts to monitor things, and 160, it'll give you a shock. So something that would be really quite embarrassing to do in a big crowd of people in a Legends triathlon. So Jack's only ever seen me flop around at the back.
Yeah.
And to everyone's amusement, he sits in the VIP tent, and from the age of about 4, he's yelled out, "You're so lame, Mum." And he's actually stood in the VIP tent and goes, "I just don't see the talent."
And that's harsh.
I know.
Oh, Jack, that's we harsh. Like you. Yeah.
But he's when I was inducted into the Sport Australia Hall of Fame, they said, you know, you can bring a partner. And I said, oh, okay. So he's what was he? What year was that? He must have been 7.
2016.
Yes, he well, 6.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, he's 6. And they said, oh, no, children can't come. And I said, well, I can't come. And they're like, oh. So I took Jack, and I said to Jack, okay, Jack, I've got to go onto the stage in a minute. I'll be back, because Jack's, you know, we do a lot together. And the video came on of my highlights of my career. And Jack went, Oh, well, we're on a podcast, you can't see. Jack's eyes just grew and he just sat there. And when I came back off the stage, he said, I didn't know you could do that. So, yeah, I think he sees things, but I'm not sure he's really understood it. He liked the first line in the book where I dedicated it to him.
Yeah, I bet he did. I asked my wife, Amelia, this morning, what do you want to know about Emma Carney? And she said, you've had all of these, or you've placed all of these massive expectations on you throughout the whole of your life. How does that level of expectation as a parent project onto Jack? Or how is it different?
Oh, well, God, parenting. People are actually quite surprised when they see Jack and I together because they're like, oh, my God, Emmy is so soft. So
Hashtag soft?
Yeah, very. So Jack's the boss, as we've already established. Mm. Because a lot of people expect that Jack would be really good at sport and he'd be doing this and this on a Saturday. And I've never taken him to an organised sporting game in my life. We spend every holiday, we go camping. So it's always outdoors. You know, we've always got the dog with us. So it's a very outdoorsy life, but there's no requirement for him, to be an athlete or no expectation. But, you know, he's also going to the same school I went. So, you know, at Wesley, he's starting that same journey, and he started doing cross country. And the other day he did a cross country. They 5 and 6 is doing on a Wednesday. And I said to Jack, probably should train, but anyway, don't go too hard too soon, because you can just see the suffering that they haven't actually touched on yet in their lives.
Yeah. Yet.
Anyway, Jack.
That'll come, son.
No, they're so lovely and innocent. Anyway, he started running and he's looking at me going, yeah? I go, yeah, good, don't go too hard. And he's running past me, yeah? And then at one point he must have just thought, oh, I'm so bored. And he got himself up to second. But then you could just see that pain hit. And I went, oh, Jack.
There it is, son. There it is.
I think he ended up 13th or something like that, and he was all upset. And he goes, and so I think maybe he has expectations on himself, and I hope not, because I know where that leads.
It's hard work. Yeah.
Read my book.
Yeah, hard work. Mm. Hey, I reckon people listening to this podcast, and many of us know exactly what you went through as a kid, those big, big dreams, right? So, you know, I wanted to play cricket for Australia. I genuinely wanted to play cricket for Australia. Nick genuinely thought he could be an Australian long jumper. I mean, hard to look at Nick and think that that's the case, but it's true. But very, very, very few people can make those dreams a reality like you have. When you think about your to-do list, what's next, and making big dreams come true, what are those big dreams?
Coaching. I still owe Australian Olympic gold medal. So that's that's my next big goal. And, yeah, navigating the minefield that is Australian sport, because it's a bit of an exhausting environment to be in.
Have you learnt how to play the game? Because you didn't play the game. Have you learnt how to do it?
I don't think I have. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I ever want to.
Right.
Because I want the results. Mm-hmm. And if you want to win, you're always going to be different and you're always going to ruffle feathers. And if you got to the end of your life and you hadn't ruffled any feathers, I really don't know if you could have achieved much, because change is uncomfortable and change is difficult and awkward, and it's isolating like it is with an athlete. So I will coach athletes, and I'd like results. But, yeah, hopefully I'd like to leave Jack – you know, and hopefully he'll have a nice start to his life, and he'll do whatever he wants to do. I think at the moment he wants to be a YouTuber.
Okay. So I've got a 10-year-old as well. Mm. He wants to be a YouTuber.
I know. And I'm like, really? Well, you got to think of an edge.
Well, we were watching this YouTube clip the other day, and he said, "Dad, how many views do you think this has had?" I said, "I don't know, a couple 10. Of million." Yeah, it was like that. I don't know, 10, 30 million views.
Mm.
And these guys are just making an absolute fortune. Yeah. Anyway, maybe Miller and Jack could make a YouTube channel together. So it's a cracking read. There's so much light and shade. As I said, I think the thing that blew me away about your book was just you had these massive big dreams as a kid and you made just about every one of them come true. Where do people get your book?
It's online or readings.
Yep.
My publisher, a little publisher, Ryan Publishing. But yeah, it's readings is the main store. I think it's Theosaurus Books also in Brighton has it. So it's it was quite funny when I wrote my book. They said to me, a lot of the really big publishing companies said to me, "Oh, Emma, if you hadn't waited 20 years to write your story," and I said, "Yeah, but half of the book is on that train wreck of a life that I was driving into the ground." So,
well, we'll put it all on the episode page.
We absolutely will. Buy it. We will. In a couple of months' time, you're 50.
Oof.
What's on the other side of 50?
Oh, pretty much the same, I think. We're not a yeah.
Are you going to have a big 50th?
Nah, no way.
What?
I've never
just
had
the three of us.
Yeah, yeah. We're happy and to Jack. Come. Yes, and Jack.
No, I don't know. I think maybe Mum, Dad, me, Claire, and her little Harry, and my little Jack. Maybe we'll go to Noosa or something like that. But no big party. No.
Just slide on through.
Yeah, whatever. It's actually quite sad when my sister died at 35 and I wasn't supposed to get to 50 first, and it's actually sad, those things. The people that you leave behind on the way. Mm. And I'm quite surprised I've made 50.
Well, we just wanted to say thank you so much for coming and talking to a couple of guys in our studio here in Elphington. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. When I answered the door a couple of hours ago, like, I really felt like I knew you, because the way that you've been able to bring your story to life through your book it's absolutely beautiful. And I'd implore anyone listening to go out and grab a copy. But thank you. You're an absolute star, and great to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've got one more thing though.
Oh,
and it's Challenge Nick. Because
yeah, right.
Lauren Foote, another Change Our Game ambassador, challenged me to get on to a set of roller skates, and then she was going to hip and shoulder me until I hit the ground.
Right.
I'm yet to do that, but we're in talks. Bridie O'Donnell tried to get me to sing. I didn't sing. She did. Where would you take me to make me suffer the most? We're not going to swim because you and I are both terrible at swimming. On a bike, where would you take me to suffer the most in Melbourne?
Oh, up King Lake and then back down again, because the descent in this weather is even worse.
Cold.
Just cold, and just the corners are
dangerous.
A little bit slippery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds terrifying.
I was going to say, why would you want to do that?
Yeah.
No, thank you again, Emma. As I said before the briefing, I grew up watching triathlons and happened to be watching your races and remember those races as well. So it's a huge honour to have you on our show, and all the best for 50 and beyond.
Oh, you have to keep talking about that. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope everyone hasn't fallen asleep.
They haven't. Thanks, Emma.
Thanks, Emma.
Thank you.
So there we have it. That was the great Emma Carney. And that's the sound, if you listen to the intro, that's the sound of Blake Collins bowling out Nick Devadas.
Yeah.
In 1983, which
is beautiful bowling,
it was
by the way.
Beautiful bowling, yeah.
Middle stump, cartwheeling out of the ground.
Cartwheeling. Only thing is, Blake, in 1983, yeah. I was 3 years old. So, well done.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I'll take it. Take any wicket.
Any wicket you can
get. Yeah. Emma Carney, like her will to win was just monstrous, and her hate to losing to lose it was just even bigger.
It was
than that will to win.
It just dominant performance after dominant performance, and that's what she aimed for.
Yeah,
it wasn't to be, you know, a sprint on the line or anything like that. It was sure I might be a little bit out of it in the swim, but over the bike leg and then the run leg, I'm going to crush you.
Yeah,
and embarrass you.
Yeah, I think, you know, we've spoken to a few elite athletes on the Dirlanders previously, and their want to do something and get and achieve something is the next level, isn't it?
Yep.
Because coming second, like, just is not an option. I think about Brody O'Donnell, and it's just such a next level want.
Yeah, I just don't think there has been an athlete quite like Emma Carney in Australia, male or female, who the will and desire to suffer, to put in the hours, and to the point where she, in essence, broke herself, is just extraordinary. And she would have been pushing herself through all sorts of pain, you know, when her heart was starting to essentially go on her, that other people just would have given up a long time before, and she did it for years and years.
Yeah. Phenomenal. Great story.
And just lovely to have in the studio.
Yeah. She was such a great person. All right. That was Emma Carney. Now, next week, who are we talking to, Nick?
Well, Blake.
Yeah.
Let me consult my notes.
Yes. I'm so prepared. Like, we are. Well, actually, what are we? 43 episodes in, and it's just not getting any smoother, is it?
I'll tell you who we do have.
Right.
It is someone who also does endurance sport, but does it in a different sort of capacity.
Yeah.
It is Henry Gold, who at the age of 50, 5-0, Emma Carney, this is what you could do after your big 5-0, is he started a global cycle adventure company.
He did, and he's talking to us all the way from Canada.
From Toronto, Maple Leafs territory.
Mm.
Hope you enjoy.
Thank you.